yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. The topic today is twofold. First, I want to talk about a publication by the international investment bank called Deutsche Bank. You ever hear of Deutsche Bank? Yeah, one of the biggest investment banks in, certainly in Europe. Deutsche Bank, kind of a sleazy organization, well known for money laundering for rich oligarchs, Russian, and of course, Donald Trump. Investigations of Deutsche Bank have been attempted on several occasions, but since they're global, they just move their money around and hide things and so forth, but it'll come out. But anyway, Deutsche Bank is one of the big shadow banks, global shadow banks, as we call them, unregulated virtually. Investment banks are unregulated, you know, Goldman Sachs and players like that. They're investment banks. And they came out with a report here, a confidential report for their shareholders and people who subscribe to it. You can't get the report. I've gotten some evidence about the report. I'm not a subscriber, but I was able to get hold of some evidence. And the report is really called The End of Globalization and the Coming of the Age of Disorder. Age of Disorder. Yeah. Interesting topic. This was really their annual. It's an annual report that Deutsche Bank puts out mostly for its shareholders, called the Long-Term Asset Return Study. Now, that'll tell you something. Asset return, stocks, bonds, right? Other financial assets. And return, profitability, in other words. What's the profitability from those asset returns? And this is a report about an end of an era, as they call it, of the last 40 years. And the fact that the coming era, next 10 years, is going to be quite different and not as, quote, profitable. That's why they call it disorder, age of disorder. And they frame it in terms of the concept of globalization. Now, globalization, as I pointed out in my book, Scourge of Neoliberalism, earlier this year, is really a code word, you know, and it serves the purpose of obfuscating what is really behind globalization, which is capitalist profits, right? And globalization can mean many things. It could mean trade, or what we call goods flows back and forth between, you know, globalization means there's more global trade, more flow of goods, trade, exports, imports. Globalization can mean more money flows. In other words, money capital in various forms, and investors and capitalists buying stocks and bonds and exchange, foreign exchange and derivatives across borders globally, right? More of that flow, or that money flow. It could mean more communications, and of course, technology has enabled that communications. And it's enabled that it's a key enabler of you know, expanding and accelerating those money flows, right? To be able to communicate, to know instantaneously what's happening in the first instant of the markets opening up in Asia or in Europe, right? And I'm going to move my money from North America to Asia here. I'm going to speculate and arbitrage and all that and make a quick profit here or there and then move my money again to another part of the world when those markets open up and then move it back instantaneous. Technology, internet has enabled that. Of course, wireless has enabled it even further. Big boost to internet. Okay, so globalization can mean communications, and it could mean travel too, right? Transport. Yeah, well, airlines, business people fly it all over the world. Yeah. Real quick, having meetings and acquiring other companies and assets and investing here and there, et cetera. Yeah, so globalization to the bankers like Deutsche Bank means money, right? And it means speculating in financial assets. It means expanding into other countries, acquiring and joint production and so forth. It means movement of skilled managerial labor back and forth, or what we call L1, L2 visa movement, right? That's a visa for business people moving into the U.S., and even skilled workers, H-1B. I mean, look, 500,000 a year for a while we were having of foreign workers coming into the United States, taking highly skilled jobs, you see, highly skilled. H-1B and L-2 is for the spouses of the managers, L-1s, you know. So, okay, globalization means moving the capitalists and their capital around. But they call it globalization. It doesn't sound so bad, does it? That's an ideological term, I believe, globalization. It's designed to obfuscate the real class nature of expanding of capital and capitalism, mostly Western, U.S., and European, and, of course, Japanese, which is an appendage of American capital, moving, penetrating emerging markets in China and other places for a while around the world. See, that's what globalization is. Now, that's the era that this report refers to. And it says 40 years, the last 40 years. So starts about 1980. Well, you know what we would call that is neoliberalism, right? That's when the neoliberal period really begins. Neoliberal capitalist period begins late 70s, early 80s. Now, I'm not going to go into explaining my view of neoliberalism. You can read in my book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism. But basically, you know, neoliberalism is an ideology. In other words, a way of justifying and legitimizing these flows of capital, money, and product, and inventory, and real, and people, etc. So it's an ideological term. So you don't have to say capitalist financial imperialism. You don't have to use that term either. You call it neoliberalism, right? So it kind of, like globalization, you know, neoliberalism has an ideological component to it. But neoliberalism, like globalization, is also real. It's a set of policies, four main areas or categories of capitalist policies. Monetary policy, central bank monetary policy. Fiscal policy, tax policy, government spending and subsidies and so forth policy. Industrial policy, which is about deregulation and privatization and deunionization and controlling wages and benefits and so forth. And what we call external policy, which is about trade, free trade, flow of goods, and flow of money, foreign direct investment, FDI in and out, and currency exchange rate policy. Now, neoliberalism, when this all started 40 years ago, and it's been developing ever since, 40 years ago, neoliberalism pretty much shook up this combination of four policy areas, shook it up. And came up with a different mix and a different emphasis. You see, we've always had these four policies, but they've had different mixes and emphases. And from time to time, U.S. capitalism has restructured itself and jumbled up the mix of the four policies and come up with, you know, a different emphasis and different kinds of implementations and so forth. The first major restructuring occurred right before World War One. Yeah, World War One. That's when we got the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and we got a new fiscal policy, new tax policy. As the U.S. was preparing to jump on the world stage and play a major role in global imperialism, which at the time was dominated by the British and the French. Yeah. And of course, it did that. It took advantage of World War One, came out the winner, leaped into a role of at least a co-equal to British imperialism. And that's when the U.S. began to expand globally, you see. Another period occurred of restructuring coming out of World War II in the mid to late 40s. The U.S. restructured those four policy areas once again and became the global imperial hegemon, surplanting the British, the French, and so forth, became the dominant global economic empire, as we call it. And that restructuring of those four policy areas, I'm not going to go into details. You can read the book. Those four policy areas kind of hit a wall in the 1970s. In the 1970s, another global and U.S. economic crisis. And out of that crisis came another capitalist restructuring, and that's what we call neoliberalism. That's what emerged in the 1980s, and it continued to evolve. You know, it didn't come full-blown under Reagan. No, certain elements were introduced under Reagan, but then other elements were added by Bill Clinton, right? That's when we started getting free trade, and we began to see the first vestiges of capitalist attack on pensions and healthcare, privatization of healthcare, which is what, you know, managed care was under Clinton, and intensifying attack on unions, free trade, right? We get NAFTA, we get China PNTR, and so forth. And deregulation of technology. So, you know, the Democrats contribute a lot to neoliberalism. And then, of course, we get George W. Bush, and we get an intensification of not only the Clinton emphases, but the intensification of the Reagan focus of neoliberal expansion. Then it hits a wall. You know, the 2008-09 crash kind of stopped it in its tracks. Obama tried to put it back together again. He couldn't. He failed. The crisis deepened in the sense that very little real economic growth under Obama, you know, maybe 60% of GDP in a recovery of normal, and then no real job restoration for 6 years. Ah, but the bankers do well. You know, the financial side is bailed out within a year, and banks and big corporations and shareholders go on to record profits, right? Trump comes along and he promises neoliberalism on steroids, right? Under Obama, it was on opioids. That's what we're experiencing now. You know, the trade wars, the massive tax cuts for businesses and investors under Trump, the massive, almost total deregulation, the forcing the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates so that lowering interest rates would mean a low dollar, because that's one of the external policies of neoliberalism, ensure a low value globally of the dollar. Why? Oh, because if I'm an American capitalist and I've expanded offshore the last 40 years, I got a lot of my production and profits offshore. Oh, but the profits may be in Argentine and Brazilian reals or Argentine pesos. I got to convert them if I want to bring them back to dollars. But if I have a low dollar, Oh, I get to bring more dollars back as I convert my Argentine pesos to dollars. If it was a high dollar, oh, well, then my profits from pesos would be less when I convert it to dollars. So you see, neoliberalism loves a low dollar policy. And the fight over interest rates between Trump and the Federal Reserve a year or two back here was really over that. You see, the Federal Reserve raised rates to try to get back some of the free money, the trillions it threw at the banks after 2008-9. That's what that was about. But it was screwing up the repatriation of multinational corporations' profits and therefore the stock market. So, Trump leaned on Powell, the chair of the Fed, and Powell capitulated. What you get is a low dollar policy, and the multinational corporations abroad of the United States love it, love it. They repatriate more profits. It means that they can invest even more offshore, and capitalism penetrates offshore quantitatively and qualitatively like never before. That's all neoliberalism and getting back to Deutsche Bank. That's what they're talking about. That this era, they call it globalization, is over or likely going to be over. And what's coming the next decade is an age of disorder, meaning opposite of above, right? We're not going to see such, lucrative profits from financial investments. We're not going to see stocks and bonds producing these speculative profits, and that's what they are. They're speculative profits. They're profits from price inflation, price appreciation of financial assets. That's what speculation in the financial markets are all about. Protect that. Make sure those markets, continue to grow, those financial markets. Well, look at what we just had here, in the last 6 months. A tremendous collapse of the real economy where jobs are, right, and wages. Tremendous collapse. Oh, but what happened to the stock market and bond market? Well, immediately after a couple weeks of a hiccup, back to record levels. In other words, capitalism's first objective is to protect the financial asset markets, to make sure they keep inflating and we keep generating speculative profits for them. Portfolio profits, we sometimes call it, stock and bond profits, but what you don't see is the profits from derivative trades or from foreign exchange trades or other kind of property exchanges, right? Commodities and so forth. You don't see that. You hear about stocks and maybe you hear about bonds, right? But it's the whole picture. The whole picture, and that's what capitalism protects first and foremost. Those financial markets and financial assets. That's why Trump, being a speculative real estate wheeler dealer, financial capitalist himself, thinks is the most important, because to them it is, you see. To them it is. Okay, so that's what this report in the first statement really looks at and says, this golden era we've had here of financial capitalist expansion and real capitalism as well, is under threat now. Oh, we better be careful. Yeah. All right. Okay. And then it goes on and it talks about eight themes, right, that are of risk here to this expansion, this continued expansion of financial assets. Digress a little bit here. What we're talking about is financialization. Neoliberalism is about the extension and expansion and deepening of the financialization of the capitalist economy, global and, of course, leading edge here in the U.S., U.K., and so forth. The expansion of that. That's what neoliberalism is first and foremost. Well, why? Why is that so important? Because financial profits from assets and appreciation and speculation is far more profitable than profits from making things, i.e. making goods. It's far more profitable. Why is it far more profitable? Well, because the costs are not there. When you make an electric car or something like that, oh, you got to invest in research and development, right? Or, oh, you've got to hire skilled people to do it. And, oh, you got to get all of this suppliers lined up, right? And they may or may not be reliable. And, oh, you got to then get raw materials from around the world to bring in. And, oh, that might be at risk to do, too. And then, you know, you got to ship this stuff. Cost of goods, they call this. The cost of goods sold, it can be very volatile and very expensive and very risky. And it takes a long time to make this stuff and to sell it. You know, develop the distribution channels and the sales function and so forth. It's not easy, and it's risky because it's longer term. Compare that to financial profits. Oh, there's no cost to goods, right? I just add an entry to an electronic database. Oh, you want more of the stock? Okay, here it is. You know, I just added a million shares. Go buy it, right? Doesn't cost me anything, right? It's just a piece of software. I mean, they don't give you a piece of paper anymore to say, oh, I own this or that bond, this corporate bond. No. It's all electronic entry. So there's no cost of goods, right? Unlimited supply. And the other element of financial assets is the demand feeds off of demand. The more people buy it, oh, the price goes up, which brings more people into the market wanting to jump on a bandwagon and take advantage of the rising price. So demand creates demand creates demand, and there's no supply problem. Well, simple supply and demand economics means the price is going to go up and up and up. And it does. Bubbles. Right? You don't get a bubble in electric cars or solar panels. Right? You get bubbles in stock prices and bond prices. Well, why do they come down? Well, because the people who got in first make the big profits. At some point, they want to, you know, farm those profits. And they sell. And then the guys who got in late, which is usually day traders, right, small people, say, uh-oh, price is going down, sell, right? But then the big boys make money on it going down by putting puts and calls on the movement, you know, options and so forth. They make money going up, money going down. Well, where in making things can you make money by selling it and make money by not selling it? Well, or selling it, you can't, okay? Well, that's just a brief explanation, very brief, of why financial markets have become the focal point of global capitalism in the last 40 years. I'm not saying that real things aren't being made. You know, there's still capitalists doing that, but more and more of them are creating in financial institutions that speculate. Speculation simply means I'm betting on the price change. And again, the price change can be up or down, you see. You get it going both ways. And the other advantage of financial asset investing is that, oh, I can jump in and jump out immediately. To make it so easy. You can jump in, maybe, but you can't jump out so easy. But with stocks and bonds and financial assets, you can. So there's less risk, you see. No cost of goods, demand-driven, price-driven, right? Far less risks, easier entry and exit from the market. All these reasons capitalism has discovered. Whoa, big money here from financial assets. And that's what the Deutsche Bank report is lamenting, you might say. Oh, this golden age, you know, might be leading to an age of disorder. That's their term, by the way, in the report. Age of disorder. Let me digress a little bit here on this question of financial speculation and profits and so forth, you know. My Marxist economic friends say, oh, that's just fictitious capital, and it doesn't matter what it is. You know, let's not even bother looking at that. That's fictitious capital, you know, has nothing to do with the real business cycles of capitalism. Well, they're absolutely wrong, you know, and it's a misreading of Volume 3 of Marx's Capital, really, where Marx talked about fictitious capital. In other words, profits made not from making goods, where workers import their labor into the goods, right? It's profits made from creating these fictitious securities, right? And allowing the price to rise and reaping financial profits. That's fictitious capital. You know, stocks and bonds and so a lot of that, most of that is fictitious capital. But when the fictitious capital goes bust, as it does when the financial system overreaches, right? They get too greedy, overreaches, and then it collapses. Well, then it freezes the banking financial system, and that causes the rest of the economy, the real economy where jobs and things are made, to collapse as well. We see this repeatedly occurring, right? Most recently in 2008 and '09. And of course, we're in it now, right? Except it's reversed, right? We don't have a financial crash causing the real economy to collapse as we did in 2008 and '09. What we got is the real economy collapsing first because of this external event called, you know, the virus. Ah, but the risk is, if this goes on and we don't have a robust recovery fairly quickly, the debt and the lack of income to finance the debt for businesses and households and governments is going to deteriorate and eventually precipitate another financial crisis. Could happen in 2021. So the causal relationship is reversed between the real economy and the financial side of the economy, feeding back on each other and exacerbating each other and causing a deep contraction of both. Yeah, it's reversed. But that's what I always called an epic recession, you see, back in 2010. Epic recessions are the relationship between the financial side and the real side exacerbating each other and causing a deeper contraction and therefore a slower, longer-term duration recovery, particularly of the real economy, right? Okay, so, you know, that's just my commentary here. It's for Marxist economic friends. It matters big time in the 21st century because it's a financialized capitalist global economy and the financialization is becoming very unstable and its bubbles and contractions are coming more frequently globally and they're becoming more synchronized globally. Okay. Let's go back to the Deutsche Bank report here. Look at the eight themes they talk about. Eight themes. Well, first, the first theme is they're worried about the U.S.-China relationship. That could spell, or one of the forces that could precipitate this age of disorder. One of the forces. It certainly has, hasn't it? Under Trump, what we've seen is this trade war. And, you know, the trade war was really dampening the global economy significantly before the virus hit. Before. Yeah, the trade war was here before. And that was having a negative effect on the global economy and on global trade. By the way, the Deutsche Bank report says that the coronavirus thing is not the cause of this coming age of disorder. You know, it just made it worse, right? And I've been saying that all year long. I've been saying, look at what was happening in the 2019 U.S. economy. It was in trouble. It was really weakening in a number of key segments here. The coronavirus just precipitated and accelerated and deepened the process of slowdown that was already coming, you know, in economics, you got to distinguish between different kinds of causation, Right? You just can't consider causation a single concept, right? There are causes that are fundamental to the trends and the direction. There are causes that enable the crisis, and there are causes that precipitate it. Three levels of kinds of causation. Right? And that's why, you know, the virus certainly precipitated and accelerated the trend, but it wasn't fundamental to the trend. Although it too now is creating fundamental changes. You see, this is all dynamic relationships here. Nothing is unilinear in economics. So moving on here, U.S.-China relationship was a problem before, but it looks like it's getting worse, according to Deutsche Bank, right? What was a trade war now is clearly a tech war, a war over technology. And, you know, I've been talking about that and writing about that as well for a couple years now, that the U.S.-China trade war is really at its core a fight over technology, next generation technology, which has an important military characteristic to it. Technologies like artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and 5G wireless. Those are the technologies that the U.S. and the China are fighting for the lead over globally. And if you looked at the trade war, it was launched over those technologies. It was originally launched by the U.S. trade representative identifying China's threat in its 2025 report that China put out, that it wanted to be the leader in those three areas. Yeah, and those, as I said, those three areas are military, right? Whoever dominates those areas, and then by 2030 will be the dominant military force. And the U.S. does not want China to leapfrog it. And that technology, look at all the patents. Who's writing all the patents in the world? U.S. and China. Everybody else is way behind. They're not even in the game. Europe's not even in the game. Japan, not even in the game. It's just China and the U.S. now. Embedded in the U.S.-China trade war was the tech war, in other words. Trump couldn't get, and the Pentagon military-industrial complex faction on the trade negotiations couldn't get China to capitulate on technology. Now, there were other elements that the U.S. had in its trade negotiations. Trump wanted to boost farm, you know, because that's farm products. That's his base, one of his bases, you see. Political bases in the Midwest and so forth. So he wanted to deliver for them and for manufacturing goods in some of the areas and for the oil and energy companies. He wanted to sell their natural gas glut we got in the U.S. To China and to Europe, by the way. You know, those were elements in it. And U.S. bankers wanted a piece of the action. They wanted to get into China and have 51% ownership of their operations, not the 49% that the Chinese would only let them have. Well, the Chinese, you know, cleverly gave the bankers what they want, split the interest on the U.S. trade team, divide and conquer, and also promised that they would buy a lot more farm goods, split that off, but wouldn't agree to the tech war. And the Pentagoners, you know, Peter Navarro and others representing that faction, didn't get what they want. So the trade war ended here back in December with Trump taking the money and run, agreeing to some of the benefits for the U.S. bankers and for the farm sector, right, and the oil and energy sector, but not for the technology military-industrial complex center. He took a minimum deal there. The Chinese prevailed, in other words. He said, oh, we'll come back in 2020 in a phase two, ha, 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 you know. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and China wasn't going to buy farm goods or anything. Look, you know, how much has China bought of farm goods? Right. Trump back in December said, oh, they're going to buy $100 billion a year for the next 2 years. How much have they bought? 30. Yeah, maybe a little bit more. Well, How much of oil and energy? Two billion, 30 billion, 2 billion, which is not even where they were before the trade war began. So the trade war, a total flop for Trump, total flop. And now, you know, he knows that, although they're covering it up, and he's attacking China, and the tech war is heating up. In other words, the sheep's clothing of trade as a source of conflict is now thrown off, and we see the essence here of the tech war in those negotiations, and that's getting worse. Yeah, the tech war is getting worse. It's not just Huawei and 5G wireless, but it's the U.S. Going after now a whole bunch of companies, technology companies, refusing visas for Chinese scientists and businesses to come over. The latest is, you got to sell TikTok, right? The tech company TikTok. And by the way, Trump says, I'm going to shake you down. The U.S. government wants a piece of that action, too. You know, it's like he's running the government, you know, like he run his business, right? Yeah, give me some money, I'll go away. That's what capitalists do all the time. Capitalist raiders, right? Go in, buy the stock, threaten to take over the company. Unless the company gives them something, then they go away, right? Well, he's shaking them down. But the tech war is going on, tech war. And it will soon, I believe, transform into a bona fide economic war, the next phase of which is currency war, and or maybe the Chinese, as the rumors are out again, not buying U.S. Treasury bonds. In other words, we're expanding this into an economic war. And that's what the Deutsche Bank report talks about, technology and U.S.-China relationships. Not to the depth I've just described it, but this could get worse, they're saying. Between the two biggest economic powerhouses in the world, China and the U.S., which, by the way, Deutsche Bank says China could easily be equivalent to the U.S. By 2028. So the two biggies here are fighting it out over technology, and who knows what the sanctions and results will be, and that will add to the age of disorder. Another point they make, another theme is that, Europe is at a crossroads. It's a make or break decade, as they say, for Europe, right? Either Europe has to get its act together and be a major player, or it's going to be left behind. The problem is Europe is far more dependent on exports than the United States. Yeah. And if you've got a slowing global economy for various reasons, how are you going to generate an expansion in Europe? You know, Europe has not been able to engage in the level of financialization that the U.S. and the U.K., which is going to be an appendage of the American economy soon, U.K., Europe just hasn't gotten its act together. It hasn't expanded its financial system. It's still traditional commercial banking, right? And it hasn't been able to keep up on technology. And it's worried of U.S. tech firms taking over what little tech it has. Europe just can't get its act together. Its whole strategy is, let's keep the euro, the currency low. So if we keep the currency low, we can keep our export prices low, and we can steal some of the global market, right? Exports and grow through trade and exports, export-driven growth, based on devaluing the currency by the central bank, European Central Bank, pumping money through the monetary system into the economy to drive the euro down and therefore expand exports and production of exports. Well, you know, that's a very risky approach because anybody can do it, right? And the U.S., of course, has the same policy of keeping its currency low. You see, they're both neoliberal, right? So it's kind of a tit for tat, race to the bottom here, driven by the central bank's policies to keep interest rates low, to keep the currency low. It's part of the currency war that's also emerging now, that's been knocking on the door for a couple years here in global capitalism. But now I believe it's with a really contracting global economy for the first time, 5% contraction of global trade expected this year, big number, that Europe isn't going to get its act together. It's not, you know. Europe, I mean, that train has left the station. Europe has been left in the station. Right? It's a two-train race here, China and the U.S. So they're worried, though, that Europe won't be able to really keep up with China in the U.S., and that could bring more disorder, right? And where you have disorder economically, you have political disorder, and where you have political disorder, you have the rise of right-wing oligarch authoritarians, you know? And you can see it in Europe already, you know? You got Hungary, you got Poland, you got a lot of places in Europe where they're drifting towards this right-wing authoritarian forms of government globally. Well, capitalism in general does that, you know? It does that, you know, in general when there's a crisis. Okay, so decade for Europe, make or break. Not good for Europe if it can't get its act together. And that will intensify the age of disorder. Debt, another theme, rising debt, right? Yeah, rising debt, not just for governments, but for corporations. It's a debt finance capitalism in the 21st century. Now, debt is okay. You can add more debt. By itself, debt is not bad, so long as you can pay the principal and interest on it. And you can only pay the principal and interest on it if you're producing real goods that you can sell and make a profit with. Hmm? Well, but wait a minute, if you're shifting investment into financial assets, you're not shifting it into real investment that increases production of real goods, hires people, and so forth, right? That you need to sell things in order to finance, right, the debt, pay for your debt, pay the principal and interest on your debt. When your income does not grow as fast as your debt, then you're in deep doo-doo, you see. Then you cannot finance it, and then you default on that debt, meaning you don't pay the principal or interest, and then when you default, you go bankrupt. And that bankruptcy, if it is widespread enough, you know, initiates widespread fear and contagion, and everybody pulls in their horns, including bankers, and then the economy collapses, you see. So debt is a big worry if you can't finance it, and if you have a slowing long-term global economy, you can't finance it. Now, the federal government can finance it by printing money, but states can't, local governments can't finance it that way. Households can't, and businesses can't. So debt is a problem in a slow, no-growth, stagnant, declining economy. And that's the problem with debt today. You know? Again, it's not just the magnitude of debt. It's where the borrowing goes. Is it going to generate income to pay for it? Or is it going, borrowing, i.e. creating debt, going to speculate in financial assets? Yeah, well, and the problem with financial assets wouldn't be, a problem if we had a financial asset tax system, but we don't, you see. There's another reason why the investment flows into assets and markets, because it's untaxed, you see. Or if you then sell, you know, you got a lower tax rate, right? The corporate tax rate is higher than the tax rate for dividends and capital gains. That's just an incentive to push money into financial markets. Okay, so debt. And, you know, the Deutsche Bank report talks about, helicopter money, meaning, you know, gee, if households can't pay their interest in debt, pay for their debt, overloaded on credit, and boy, are we in the U.S., right? Really, what, $13, $14 trillion household debt now? You know, record debt and student debt and credit card debt, you know, installment debt of various kinds, auto debt. Yeah. Well, then at some point, going to have to provide some sort of helicopter money. And that's where the central bank would just sort of give money to households so they could make sure they pay their debts to the investors that loan them the money, you see. It's really going to go to people who are asset owners in the end here. That creates inequality. Inequality. Yeah, well, financialization is the big driver behind the inequality. You know, inequality is a relative term. You know, inequality can get worse if you're a worker and you're laid off and you got no income, right? Or you're not getting wage increases, or you have to pay more for your benefits and therefore, you know, you don't have any assets. Or if you're a retiree and you can't earn any savings because interest rates are so low, right? That can exacerbate inequality. You know, the rich will get richer simply because the middle and the poor get poorer. You know, in a relative sense, the rich will get richer. But the real cause, the even bigger driver of inequality, is the wealth and the income accruing, flowing, going to the 1% and 1/10 and 1/100%. You know, if they get richer and a working class simply does not increase, well, then you're going to get more inequality. And of course, the financialization is the big cause of the inequality because it's the big force that's driving up the incomes and wealth of the 1%. As I've said before, look, how much have corporations, which are the conduit for this wealth transfer to the rich, how much have they given to their shareholders in the last 3 years under Trump? $3.4 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. $3.4 trillion, folks. And then they lowered the tax rate so they get to keep more of it. And under Obama, $7-8 trillion. $10 trillion flowing to shareholders. Well, you don't think that exacerbates the income inequality, especially when wages don't grow? Yeah. So we're still, because under the age of disorder, wage incomes are going to collapse even more. So it's going to intensify. It's going to get worse. Okay, so they're worried about that. And they say, oh, it's going to lead to a fight over taxation. Well, sure it will. You know, people are going to say, hey, wait a minute. Why are you getting such a good tax break, not paying any taxes, you know, or putting your profits offshore like Apple does? 95% of its $250 billion in cash is kept offshore so it doesn't have to pay profits in the U.S. They all do that. All the big investors do that. Keep it offshore so the government doesn't know even how much there is in most cases. Right? So inequality they're worried about. Deutsche Bank is worried about. Intergenerational divide, another theme. Yeah, millennials versus... as they would like to say, retirees, millennials versus boomers, huh? As if it was a intergenerational problem. No, it's a capitalist problem. Yeah, millennials have taken it in the ear here with the low wages, low jobs, low paid service jobs that now are being wiped out more, right? Exacerbated by the pandemic, right? But it was a problem before, turning to gig work, more and more, trying to make ends meet. No wonder these young people were so pissed off in the street, and not just blacks. They're pissed off because the young people know they got no future. They're indentured under capitalism today. They're indentured. They got no financial, economic future, and they know it. And, I mean, they can't even form families, you know. A record number of them are having to live with their parents now and everything. It's disgusting what they've done to the millennials. I don't understand why more of them aren't out there. Maybe they're all, you know, addicted to their social media and don't know what's going on. But anyway, the jobs just aren't going to be there. And when artificial intelligence hits, you know, it's going to wipe out 30% of the occupations, according to McKinsey consultants. And it's hitting already. It's accelerated by the pandemic. You know, what is AI? What is artificial intelligence? Oh, it's just the elimination of simple decision-making jobs that software will do now. Right? Statistics, software, databases, computing power will make these simple decisions. The software machines will be smart enough They don't need people to do it. Yeah. So even those jobs are going to go away. That's why they talk about, well, maybe we need helicopter money, you know, throw some money at it, because just to keep them quiet, because, you know, we're going to have some insurrections going on here. Well, you know, the protests are a form of beginning of the insurrections. Climate crisis and debate going to get much worse. Yeah, well, I live in California. Tell me about the climate crisis. Tell me about it, you know. And people on the East Coast, you know, tell them about the hurricanes in the South Coast. Tell them about the hurricanes. Right? Tell the people in the Midwest about blizzards now occurring in September. Yeah. Oh, there's no global warming. I mean, how stupid can you get? Yeah. Well, some people can get that stupid and more. And we got about 30% of them in this country that fall in that category, I'm afraid. Right? Technology. Is this going to be a revolution or a bubble? Deutsche Bank says. Well, it's going to be both. As I said, we got the AI revolution. Technology continue and will accelerate because it's part of the war with China, you see? And it's big profits in software, you know? Maybe not as big as in financial assets where there's no cost of goods, but the cost of goods in software is far less than making hardware. So software is far more profitable, you see. Especially if you have software-driven companies like Uber, where you throw the cost of the hardware onto the backs of the workers, right? They got to provide their car and the insurance and all that, right? And you're going to have bubbles, more and more bubbles in technology. Technology is going to be more destabilizing than it even is now. Will that result in inflation or deflation, according to Deutsche Bank? Both. You see, all this money out there is being thrown at financial markets. Too much money chasing too few goods has always been an argument in economics of the cause of inflation. And they just haven't been able, economists, to figure out, well, why with all this massive increase in trillions and trillions of dollars in the economy pumped by the central bank, and created even digitally now, you know, why don't we have super inflation in the cost of consumer goods going on, right? Well, because the money's not going into the hands of people who would buy these goods. It's going into the hands of investors who invest in financial markets. So we got inflation in financial markets. We got bubbles. We don't got inflation in goods markets. Because that's not where the money is going. And the structural changes, destroying unions and so forth, has kept in globalization here, has kept the wages down. And the layoffs, more layoffs, have kept wages down. More part-time work and temp work has kept wages down. Limiting overtime pay has kept wages down. Not right raising minimum wages has kept wages down. Okay. So really, what the Deutsche Bank study is saying and looking at is, you know what? Neoliberalism's in trouble over the next 10 years. Well, that's what I said in the concluding chapter of my book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism. Check it out on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can go on Amazon or wherever and read sections of it. So that's the Deutsche Bank. In other words, the bankers know what's happening. The bankers know what's going on. Maybe the politicians are just spinning this nonsense about V-shaped recovery. By the way, you know, I talked about that last week. V-shaped recovery for who? 25% unemployment still? And that's a recovery? And it's getting worse? Yeah. Well, check out my article on my blog as well. Just published Counterpunch and elsewhere, you know, America's current jobs great depression. It's not 8.4% the media keeps, you know, hammering us with. It's 25%, and I explain why it's 25%. Read it. Okay. So the bankers know what's coming. The bankers know, you know, even if the people are treated like mushrooms, fed shit and kept in the dark by the media. They know. You know, it really irks me. The media keeps saying 8.4%, you know, And that's what it keeps, you know, hammering us with. And, you know, even progressives keep repeating 8.4%, 8.4%. I mean, just look at the numbers. Even the government's numbers, it's not 8.4%. That's the cherry-picked, lowball number that the media throws out at us. Okay, so the other topic, very briefly here, because we're running out of time, a couple of minutes, is what's happening with the not negotiations over the stimulus bill here between Democrats and Republicans in Congress. Well, you remember I've said in the past, the Republicans in July put out a $1 trillion package. The Democrats were at $3 trillion, and the Democrats thought, well, we'll agree to $2 trillion here. We'll split the difference, and then the Republicans and Trump, you know, sandbagged them, as they say, and walked out after they got the Democrats to lower to $2 trillion, broke off negotiations. And then Trump did his executive orders, taking control of the bargaining agenda. Well, now, you know, we got the Republicans coming out in the Senate with another proposal, even less than $1 trillion, even less. It's really about $300 billion. And they're going to take $350 billion that wasn't spent from the March CARES Act and throw that into the package. So it's not a net increase. You know, the question I have, $350 billion sitting around there, why the hell aren't they spending it? You know, I mean, certainly 30 million small businesses, they gave out loans only to 5 million, what, 25 million small businesses, and they got $350 billion sitting there? What the hell's going on? Well, you know what's going on. It's politics. Anyway, the Republicans and McConnell in the Senate are retreating even further in their offer, right? They're reducing it and reducing it. You know, part of what that $300 billion they're willing to agree to is $20 more billion for big farmers. $20 more billion. Well, we gave them $29 billion during the trade war. We gave them another $20 billion in March in the CARES Act. That's $49. They want to give them another $20 billion. $69 billion we're handing out to agribusiness. Yeah, $69 billion. And, of course, they want legal protections, liability protections. Right? They want to $300 a week supplemental unemployment, which is what Trump is using now by taking money from the disaster relief fund for 4 weeks while they want to say, okay, through December, you know, get Congress and the taxpayer pay the $300 billion. Well, they'll probably keep the tax the tax cut and payroll tax cut and other measures that Trump has in his executive orders and $300 a month just through the end of the year here. Right. Only $29 billion for health care. Right. Nothing for state and local governments, by the way, nothing at all. And they're going broke soon. Oh, new tax credits for private schools and homeschooling. Yeah. New tax credits. Let's give these charter schools even more money. Right. Private schools. So the rich folks there in the suburbs of New York City can keep sending their kids to their expensive $20,000 a year kindergartens, right? Yeah. Well, we'll have tax cuts for them, but we won't give any money to the tens of millions of people who are being evicted here from their rents, right? So that charade goes on. That goes on. And the Democrats don't dare agree to this because they will then be complicit to the whole charade, you know. And by the way, you know, the Republicans say, oh, we don't need to spend as much because it's only 8.4% unemployment and getting better, right? Well, you see the role how the media and ideology plays in policies, and policies particularly that screw workers, while policies that benefit the shareholders, you know, aren't really talked about that much. Okay, so that's the Deutsche Bank report here, reflecting where the capitalists really see things going. And that's where things are really going with this phony negotiations over a stimulus bill. And the longer they don't pass a significant stimulus bill, the more obvious it's going to be we're going to have another relapse of the economy. And if we have a relapse of the economy in the winter, at the same time we have an intensification of COVID over the winter, and at the same time we have a political crisis of historic dimensions coming in November, December, January, right, which is going to dampen the economy as well, we have a triple hit to an already weakened economy. And long-term jobless, as I've argued in my article, is continuing to emerge here. By early 2021, it could be a mess. You think it's bad now? It could be an even greater mess. A total mismanagement by the capitalist elite in both wings of the corporate party of America, aka Trumpublicans and Democrats. A total mismanagement going on. They cannot deal with the crises. They are so at loggerheads with each other that they're intensifying it. Well, we better do something on our own. Don't rely on those folks any longer. Okay, I'm out of here.